This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Marietta McCarthy finds the lessons of philosophy in the most intriguing places. With small children in elementary school, with dying patients in hospice centers, with former strangers in grocery lines. Now, Marietta is encouraging all of us to discover deep-seated meaning while gathered around tables full of delicious meals, alongside longtime loved ones and soon-to-be new best friends. Ms. McCarthy's newest book is a roadmap on how to accomplish this, food recipes included, but even more impressive, the amount of nutrition for the mind squeezed into this small, unusually shaped new tome. The book is titled The Philosopher's Table, and we will dive right in, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The book is titled The Philosopher's Table. The subtitle, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club, Monthly Conversation, Music, and Recipes. So as you can guess, there is a lot here, and we will meet the author in just a moment. But to you who are listening, is there a type of philosophy that most appeals to you? How do you define the term philosophy? And have you ever tried to gather together groups of people to share different philosophical ideas? You can reach us by phone at 888-WMRA-TALK. Even if you have not heard her here before, you will certainly note very soon that our guest loves to talk with people about their ideas and about their ideas on ideas. So you're certainly welcome to call in at 888-967-2825. Author of the new book, The Philosopher's Table, Marietta McCarthy. So great to see you back in the Insight Studio.
Nice to be back with you, Tom.
How come it's been more than 3 years since you were last here?
It takes a while to write a book.
I guess that's
that's the only reason I come to see you.
So. Yeah, I was afraid of that. So we're going to have to get you to start coming even between books. But what do you hope, Marietta, the people are going to get out of this newest book?
In the book, in the introduction, Tom, I was realizing as I was rereading some passages this morning that I say this. I imagine countless always changing faces talking and eating around philosophy tables. Quite a treat to know that people speak face to face now, enjoying an exceptional kind of evening, feeding mind and body in comfortable companionship. And that, in a way, is exactly what I'm hoping for. I was thinking of astronauts' descriptions of what the Earth looks like from so far away, this little blue dot, and that how what we value is all in this little blue speck. And so I have 12 chapters in the book, 12 places on the earth, that blue speck that holds everything for us. And so we get to take a cultural trip and set a different cultural table every month. January in Japan, February in England, March in Burma, come towards the end of the year. October in Germany, November in China, December in France. And so it's an opportunity for people to come together. I think all food is really comfort food. It's what holds us together. It makes relationships. It breaks ice. And in this coming together to have dinner, the book outlines some cultural things to talk about and learn about. The topics I've chosen for the books are ones that I think are extremely important to almost everyone today. So I've got a topic that matched the culture. And so we look at that culture, think about it. I have a philosopher from that culture and a discussion question to talk about at dinner, although tangents are welcome. And then we have what guests can bring and then what the host cooks. So there are actually recipes in the book. And there's a playlist, music, to enhance. You can play the music before the dinner, after, during, whatever. But it's music from that culture, and again, that matches, as the food matches, the topic that will be discussed.
Marietta McCarthy, one of the things that I get a very strong sense of in this book, as in your previous books, is in your mind there are no absolutes. There are no shoulds. There are no you must do it this way. So whether it's the months that you're suggesting, the particular cultures that you're suggesting in the book, even the types of food or the particular philosophers and ideas to discuss, it's almost every paragraph, even if you are not saying it explicitly in that paragraph, I get the feeling as I'm writing or reading it that what you were writing is you could try it this way, but if this sparks an idea for a different way to get people together, to have food and conversation and talk about ideas, it's going to be wonderful.
That's right. Absolutely. I heard from someone from the West Coast who was trying the Clementine souffle, and she didn't have a souffle dish. So she improvised and did the souffle in three shallow pie plates. And it was not a pretty picture that she sent me. But everyone had a wonderful time. It apparently tasted all right, although it was visually unappealing. And so there's improvising, and everyone contributes what they want. The recipes serve eight. And so what you find is that the guests, for example, may have photographs of the culture being looked at, or they may have seen a particular film, although I talk about film and music and that sort of thing, architecture.
Well, Marietta, you go into so many different things that it may be difficult for people to grasp some of what we're talking about. So let's go to the chapter where the Clementine souffle is used as one of the suggested foods, and tell us specifically about that chapter and how Clementine souffle relates, if it does.
All right. That's the last chapter in the book, and the chapter is titled Dare You. So it's about taking chances and taking possibilities and opportunities and reaching out for them. And it's December, and it's spent in France. And so I talk about the value of accepting daring in our lives. Then we have prepping for France. So their movies and their places to look at in Paris. And
what are some of the movies? Do you remember?
An American in Paris, Amelie, Francois Truffaut's Jules and Jim, for
example.
And
are there particular philosophers that for
yes,
this?
Yes, the philosopher. I choose one philosopher for each chapter. I choose the very dynamic Simone de Beauvoir for this particular chapter. And
some of Beauvoir's specific ideas?
Yes. Yes, from specific works. So after I've talked about daring, I then talk about what she has to say on this particular topic, and I use many of her works to support that. And
but the food doesn't, like the Clementine souffle, doesn't necessarily have to speak to the philosophical topic. It just is somehow connected to the culture?
Well, it certainly does. It takes a little daring to fix a souffle.
Okay.
timing is everything. So it was chosen for that reason. And actually, pot-au-feu is the first thing, the entree, essentially. And that was the de Beauvoir specialty. She served it to the French existentialist companions in thought in her day. She was known for it. That's one reason it's chosen. And then salmon cooked on a bed of salt is the appetizer. And that's a kind of a smoky, like the jazz haunts of the 30s and 40s with sort of gypsy jazz in Paris. So the food and the particular recipe and the topic, it's all interwoven for that evening. So Clementine souffle is no accident. And I have many, many people, even though the book doesn't come out for a week, many people who have around the country who've tried the dinner parties and the recipes, and each will attest that Clementine souffle is an event with everybody gathered around to see what's going to come out of the oven.
Our guest on this edition of Virginia Insight, philosophy teacher and education consultant, Marietta McCarty. Her newest book is The Philosopher's Table: How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club, Monthly Conversation, Music, and Recipes. And if you'd like to talk with Ms. McCarty, we've got the phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Next to Woodstock, Glenn, thanks for calling us here on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Well, thanks for having me. My comment is it's actually much easier to find these conversations in the public realm. Anytime you go to an art opening or go look at art, you're actually experiencing a plethora of opinions, of philosophical opinions, as expressed through the work, freestanding or engaged on the walls of an art show. It just is dependent on you to try and read that.
Well, Glenn, I would say I certainly value art, and there's a lot of art mentioned in the book, but not everyone has that access. But everyone can have people for dinner and have time for good conversation. I don't think there's one way to have a good conversation, and my suggestions in this book are just one of many ways to do that.
Oh, I have to disagree with you a bit on that, because there are many, many, many opportunities to go see art out there. It's just a few people are willing to venture forth for that.
And Glenn, it strikes me as I listen to you and Marietta that there are some commonalities between what I'm hearing from you and what I've seen in Marietta's book, because Marietta, it seems to me that one of the things that you are encouraging is gathering not only people you know, but people that you've never met before for these
Absolutely.
Philosophical discussions. You have friends bring their friends,
right,
or visitors from someplace else in the world, and all of a sudden you have people talking who have never encountered each other before, including the host, and some of them from wildly disparate cultures and upbringing. And my guess, Glenn, is what you're talking about, if you go to different kinds of art events, that you're likely to start conversations with people from walks of life that you might never have imagined encountering.
Right. We have a tendency to insulate ourselves with people whose opinions we're already fairly well versed, and I think venturing outside of your comfortable realm and into something that's not quite so sure, you'd be surprised what you learn about yourself.
Glenn, thanks so much for taking the time to share those thoughts with us. Phone number here on Virginia Insight is 888-967-2825. If you prefer a memory tool, you can remember it as 888-WMRA. Talk. We also accept posts of comments and questions on our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. The book, The Philosopher's Table, the author, Marietta McCarty, the topic, philosophy. We're welcoming your thoughts. Define philosophy.
I define philosophy as the art of clear thinking. And I think the ability to think clearly and to cut through confusion in any society at any time is not that easy. And I think it's especially difficult today. So in The Philosopher's Table, I describe mental clarity, Rob, this way. It's a no-nonsense way of understanding the world as it is. A razor-sharp mind weeds out what is irrelevant and off-track, cutting to life's core, prying it open with inquisitiveness. Shaping such a mind takes work. Just as a concert oboist and a chef in training diligently hone their skills, mental clarity requires similar daily maintenance. Missteps are inevitable. Prejudging situations and people, reacting without thinking, falling under anger's sway. Recognizing confusion when it rears up becomes easier, though, and vigilance pays off. Practicing clear thinking readies the mind for everything.
You taught philosophy at Piedmont Virginia Community College for some 20 years or more.
Yes.
You studied philosophy at a major university, at the University of Virginia, where you got your master's. How many people did you run into for whom philosophy is some kind of profession who felt that the definition was the art of clear thinking?
Not very many. And I didn't have that definition, and I'll tell you how I came up with it.
Well, that's a good tease. We've got to pause for the break. We're going to continue our conversation with educator, consultant, motivational speaker, and author Marietta McCarty in just a bit more than 1 minute. Okay, we're giving away secrets here. Marietta McCarty's first teaching experience was as a teenager giving summer camp tennis lessons not far from her hometown of Richmond, Virginia. I'm not going to tell you how many decades ago that was, but she remembers it, and she says that even then her young students were asking the type of questions that were the basis for great discussions in philosophy. After getting a master's in philosophy at the University of Virginia, she did a fair amount of middle school teaching and then spent some 2 decades as a professor of philosophy at Piedmont Virginia Community College. Her previous books, Little Big Minds and How Philosophy Can Save Your Life, are still generating plenty of conversation, but it is her latest we are focused on today, and it is titled The Philosopher's Table. So you're going to defend for me why a good definition, Marietta, of philosophy is the art of clear thinking.
As best I can. It was my first night of teaching at the community college, very first night, complete rookie. So seeing students come into the classroom, wondering if they're going to pick up on the fact that it's my first night. I'm wondering if they're tired after a long day at work, and I'm really excited. It's opening night. And so I began by defining the word philosophy as the love of wisdom, which is literally the definition of it. From the very back of the room, a man raised one hand, and with the other he slapped his desk, and he said, "Lady, you've confused me." And I think he could have given me a little more time, but here's what I realized, Tom. He'd been at work all day. He was coming in to take a 3-hour course, and he wanted something that he could use, that would be valuable, that would make a difference in his life. And the love of wisdom was too abstract. It didn't mean anything. And I went home that night. It was a night class, met once a week. And I thought about it all week. And so I came back with the art of clear thinking. I think it's an art because I think to empty the mind of all of our preconceived notions and clutter and assumptions, that's not an easy thing to do. And then to be able to think with space in our minds very clearly about what ideas mean is not an easy thing to do. I think it's an art. I think that it's something that, like any other art, requires great practice to do it. But to recognize that it takes effort, I think is really important. The students, these 30 night students, on my second night with them, they understood what the art of clear thinking meant.
What does the art of clear thinking mean to you?
Well, it means that when I'm talking about ideas or I'm presented with a problem, that I can cut to the chase and I have some sense in my own mind of what I mean when I say I'm feeling joy, or I think that I need to be more rational about some feeling of anger, or I think I need to think more about what the good life entails, that I have some sense of what those things mean, and that I can think clearly about them, that I'm not being derailed by society's opinions or preconceived notions that I may have. And I remember very, very vividly being at a literary festival, and a man raised his hand, and again, I should know by now about these raised hands and these certain expressions on faces. And what he said was, "When I told my wife I was coming to hear your talk, she said philosophy was a bunch of," and then he used his expression for what she thought philosophy was. And clearly, this was not his wife's idea of what philosophy was. This was his idea. And he said...
And he used words we cannot repeat on the radio.
Precisely. Okay. And so he said, "What would you say to my wife?" And what I said to his wife essentially was that if philosophy is clear thinking, a life without mental clarity is a very small life, and it's too hard to live that way. It's really hard to live without some clarity about what ideas mean. So that if I don't understand what communication is, how can I talk with you, and vice versa? If I'm fuzzy about the meaning of happiness, if I'm fuzzy about the meaning of goodness, and if I'm if I'm drowning in self-absorption, how can I get to know you? So I would rather be clear about what's important and what the things I think are important mean. I think it's an easier way to live and a more fruitful, rich way to live.
So to you who are listening to this conversation, maybe you're familiar with the saying, the more I learn, the more I understand how little I know. Over the years, do you feel you've come to know more answers, or maybe feel like you've just come up with better questions? Willing to share your observations with us? Our phone number is easy to remember. It's 888-WMRA. Talk in all numbers. That's 888-967-2825. Author, educator, and professional philosopher Marietta McCarty is our guest. Her new book is titled The Philosopher's Table. Marietta, I think it's been a little more than 6 years since the first time you and I spoke, shortly after your first book, Little Big Minds, which was about philosophy for children, came out. And I want to admit to you that growing up, I experienced a lot of terror, and maybe that residue, or maybe lots of children have a similar experience. Well, probably not the same as mine, but there are lots of things we don't understand we are afraid of as kids. And I will admit that some of that has stayed with me as an adult. So maybe it was fear that kept me from ever wanting to talk to anybody who called themselves a philosopher, let alone study philosophy. But I also got to say that reading your books, they're nothing like what I expect philosophy to be. It's always seemed to me that philosophy was kind of a cold intellectual exercise, ideas absent of heart and feeling and emotion and connection. And everything in your books is about people connecting with each other and opening up heart spaces and affection for one another. And the closest that you come, I think, to talking about an intellectual concept is stepping back and having respect for other people's ideas, no matter how different they may be from your own. That doesn't feel like what I think most people's definition of philosophy is, or is it just that I'm so bizarre that I don't understand?
Well, you may be bizarre, but I don't think your take on this particular topic is off at all. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from people, oh, philosophy, you know, it's something I can't do. Well, philosophy is entering the world of ideas, and it's thinking as if for the first time, not what you've already thought, but thinking as if for the first time. For example, I love to think about what kindness means. I think kindness is one of the most powerful forces in the world. What does it mean? Aung San Suu Kyi from Burma, she actually defines it because it's important to know when you're talking about it what that might be. So I think that professional philosophers have, unfortunately, in many cases, removed philosophizing from the reach of ordinary folks such as you and I. And I think that's extremely unfortunate because I think we're all naturally engaged in the world of ideas. I think sometimes critics in different fields, literary critics, art critics, make people feel, I can't read that book. I'm not smart enough. I can't go to the museum. I'm not smart enough. Well, sure you can. And so what I try to do is make, I think philosophy is very just so fertile and full of ideas, is to make it accessible. And teaching in a community college or doing philosophy with children, you've got to make it accessible because those 30 night students who'd worked all day, they would get up and walk out of the room if I began to talk in an abstract way. I was at an Ivy League.
So is it reasonable to say that your take on philosophy is simply the discussion of ideas to see if those ideas might have value in your life?
That's part of it. I will say that as given now the third book and my time spent in the world of ideas, always in discussion, because I think although reflection and introspection are wonderful, that we discover things when we talk together, that we can't deliver in solitude a lot of the times. I think I do have a sense of the ideas and concepts that if better understood, would enrich our lives. So in all three of my books, that's my table of contents. I think, for example, in the philosopher's table, to talk about persistence and grace is very important. I think that would be nice to have in one's life.
Well, I want to follow up on that, but we do have some people who've been waiting on the line for a bit, so let's get to some of these calls. Next to Winchester, Lori, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for Marietta McCarty, please.
Thank you. I think you're both doing such a great job. I have found that I just love striking up a conversation with somebody in line or whatever. But sometimes when you have your friends and you're trying to talk about philosophy, somebody has an idea and it's completely different from your idea, and then they just want to stop the conversation because they don't want to continue because they think that you're not agreeing with them. So I was wondering if you had any suggestions. I think it was great in the beginning when this person who was talking about art was saying, you know, that's another way to strike up conversation. And you sort of kept the conversation going and helping it all under, you know, everybody had something to contribute and everything was important. I just don't know how to calm people down sometimes when they get so excited about their own idea and then don't want to hear anybody else's.
Lori, I'll tell you, your phone call is a dream come true for me. And thank you for what you have to say about the previous phone call and about your difficulty in talking with your friends. I give a lot of suggestions in the philosopher's table about how to have a conversation. And there are barriers to conversation that I think we all need to recognize. I think the need to prove a point and to be right, some sense of convictions that won't let go, brush offs and mocking when people speak, that all makes the conversation very, very difficult. And so what I'm aiming for and what I write a lot about in the philosopher's table is what I would call a soft relationship, in which the conversation has some yielding in it and some compromise, and it's without confrontation. That doesn't mean it's weak and that you're not speaking your voice, but that it's got this healthy give and take to it. And so when you bring the group together and have a conversation, the reason that I've chosen these particular topics in the book, they're much easier to talk about than other topics might be. So that, for example, I have a chapter called A Slow Dance with Nature, and it's about realizing that everything changes and how to adapt and live our lives accepting that change is the one constant. Well, that's not political. Right. That's not religious. That's looking at the ocean and the sea oats and the changing colors of the sunset and looking at changes. So I have deliberately chosen topics that are non-threatening, although they are important, and tremendously important issues lie within that topic. But the way they're presented is done intentionally to allow you and the people around the table to come together. And I suggest in the introduction that everybody understand what it means to have good conversation. And I deal with that right up front at the beginning of the book.
Thank you so much. And that is such a beautiful answer. And what you were saying before, just before my call, about having grace and trying to implement that in the whole realm of the conversation, I appreciate it so much. And thank you for your interview and thank you for your book. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Lori, thanks so much for your call. We're going next to Charlottesville. Skyler, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for the author of The Philosopher's Table, Marietta McCarty, please.
Yeah, I just had a little story. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I went to Christopher Newport University as a freshman in college, and I took a philosophy class, and I learned a lot in a psychology class that I learned a lot in also, both being fields that I didn't pursue. I went into chemistry, but but they're at the forefront of my mind all the time. And in the psychology class, we talk about beliefs and what, like, different kind of beliefs you can have. And my sister's getting married on Saturday in Sandersville, and so I'm supposed to read this thing that I'm writing, and I'm had to use a bunch of critical thinking techniques to make sure it comes out clear and concise, and it takes a little time. And so I just realized how important it is. And that's funny that you just had the show today and when I'm finishing up what I'm writing.
Well, I think that one thing I find in, particularly in my college students, is that they, after this studying philosophy and learning to speak with others, that being more careful with words comes naturally. Their writing improves tremendously because they're getting this sort of going to the gym in their mind. And it's, you're really proof of that point, that these courses that you took, although you went into chemistry, are helping you with Saturday's big event.
Yeah. Basically what it's about is I just have this belief that I think I know, but I don't know for sure, that kind of love comes from the light and the warmth from the universe. And, you know, where would we be without that energy anyway?
Well,
we wouldn't exist, really.
The a chapter that I looked very forward to writing, that's August in Kentucky, is a chapter called What About Love? And in that, one of the most exciting dinner parties I've ever attended was one in which everybody ran around the table and searched to try to express this word that we use all the time, bandy it about. But what do we really mean by that word? So that was an electric dinner party.
Just for the sake of anybody who is only recently tuned in, your book is set up where month by month you are suggesting topics for that month, a philosopher who's connected to those topics, food to go with that topic, discussion points, and places in the world where these ideas resonate or may originate from. So when you say August in Kentucky, this is a particular chapter mm-hmm. where this all these issues are exemplified. You're suggesting this dinner party for August focused on the state of Kentucky as opposed to France or Burma or the
right.
other places.
Right.
And then the ideas that you were just discussing. Skylar, I got to ask, this wedding that's coming up, your sister's wedding, what you're writing, is this a toast that you're supposed to give?
No, it's during the ceremony. It's just she asked me if I would write. She asked me if I would read something, and I didn't like really what she was suggesting. It didn't really seem like I could memorize that. I felt like it would be easier for me to just read something that I wrote.
And the topic is about love.
Right.
Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts on this, your process on that. And we don't want you to give it away because it's got to be fresh on the wedding day coming up this weekend. But we do wish you the very best. Thanks so much for calling us. And maybe in a later Virginia Insight, you can call back and tell us how it went.
It's going to be a hit, Skylar.
We're going to continue here with Marietta McCarty, author of the new book, The Philosopher's Table, in just a bit more than 1 minute. The book is titled The Philosopher's Table, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club, Monthly Conversation, Music, and Recipes. Its author, Marietta McCarty, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Talk to me about the taxi driver in New York City who was from Haiti. This was the chapter about simple pleasures?
That's right. And often when I'm talking with people about education and what it means, we talk about teachers. They show up in our lives all the time. And one of my greatest teachers will always be my Haitian charioteer, the cab driver who picked me up. And I was in New York to speak about my second book, How Philosophy Can Save Your Life. And he asked me what ideas I was talking about. And whenever we came to a stop, he would make eye contact through the mirror. And sometimes at a complete stop, he'd get excited and turn around and speak with me. And he said, oh, he said, yes. He said, it's the little things in life. And what really was touching was in the cab, there were pictures of his family. And he was from Haiti, and it was right after the earthquake had happened. And you could see sadness in his face, but he's almost bouncing. He said, yes, what I love is just these pure pleasures that we have back home when we gather around and we have dinner and you take your shoes off after a hard day working and we listen to music and we dance. And it's just those little things that don't cost anything. And so we talked, and I was completely mesmerized by him, and his face had this radiance to it. And the taxi sort of rolled to a stop, and I was sorry. I wanted to say I needed to go someplace else because I didn't want to get out. And I said, how much is this? Will it be? And he said, I don't want any money. This conversation was my payment, and I thank you very much. And I knew he meant it, and I was just flush with gratitude for the whole experience. And he pulled out something back of some receipt and said, write down the name of your book for me. And I did. And I stood in the sort of the snow and watched him drive away. And the person waiting for me was my editor in New York. And he said, what was happening? I almost came out to see what was going on with the cab. Was there a problem? And when I told him what happened, he said, I think, you know, you're from the South. You misunderstood. I think you need to pay. That can't possibly have happened. But it did. It was beautiful. And just his appreciation for everything about life. Nothing he mentioned cost a penny. And he didn't want a penny from me. That was one of the finest moments of my life.
You write about simple pleasures in your other books as well as in this one. And as clear a topic as that is, and as much as anybody who hears the phrase simple pleasures knows exactly what you're talking about, it turns out to be one of the most controversial things that you talk about, doesn't it?
People are drawn to this topic, and it's always curious to me. I think we realize that we need to simplify our lives. There's too much busyness. We could do something about it. We know that simple pleasures are abundant. Friendship, for example, is one I talk about in the chapter in The Philosopher's Table. Friendship is the greatest simple pleasure, according to Epicurus, the philosopher whom I use. And we shortchange our friendships. We spend our times in ways we shouldn't. And I think, Tom, the reason for the controversy is that while we're drawn to the simplicity of the sound of rain, we're also drawn to advertising, and we're drawn to the mall at 4 o'clock in the morning after Thanksgiving when the pumpkin pie hasn't even been digested, and there we are waiting for the stores to open. And we're accumulating stuff. And we're letting so much beauty go by, and we want to stop it, and yet we feel part of this some sort of competition, and we can't. So I think that's one reason for the draw of this topic. One great simple pleasure is to enjoy something that you do really well and to spend some time doing it. My friend Kevin is a great harmonica player, and he has a full-time job, but he started playing the harmonica in a band. He's really happy. It's his greatest simple pleasure is his ability to blow that little harmonica. And so going back to some things that we relish, that we do, salsa dancing, whatever it may be, just to do that, that gives us great pleasure. And, you know, sometimes the best buy is, I'm going to suggest, no buy. That's not what's going to provide us pleasure in the long run.
So let me just make sure I understand. And I think I do, because I read the description in the book. But when you're saying the best buy, what you're talking about is being in a store and purchasing something, thinking somehow it's going to make my life a little easier or a little better,
yes,
or I really want this. What you're saying is when you're thinking about purchasing something, maybe the best purchase is to not purchase
anything.
Yes,
I am.
Talk to me about Burma, Well, I guess sometimes now known as Myanmar, and the chapter that you wrote that's connected to that part of the world, the Nobel Prize winner, and kindness.
Yes. That was the last chapter I wrote in the book. I saved it for last because Aung San Suu Kyi is so active. I didn't know what was going to happen next there. And I think it's in my lifetime.
And she is the woman who's was under house arrest for like
20 years, the better part of 20 years.
The military dictatorship. During that period of time, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes, and was unable to accept it because of the house arrest. And as a model of persistence and grace, she has wore down the dictatorship with nonviolent means. She listened. She asked questions. She always wanted to meet with them. She said, you know, and humor was her great ally. She said, you know, why do they have barbed wire around here? I'm so frail and weak. And I've said I don't want to leave my home. I wouldn't accept exile. And they're guarding me. I don't want to leave. So she could laugh at herself. But she, with flowers in her hair, walked through line after line of raised rifles in order to speak to the people about bringing democracy to Burma. And to me, what she has done is so large, so huge in our lifetimes. You know, we know King and we know Gandhi and we know Mandela, but what this woman did with this soft relationship, this yielding and compromise, is absolutely amazing. So Aung San Suu Kyi, Tom, says, and I'm very touched by this, that the thing that matters most to her in her life is kindness. And she says that in the most difficult times, even a small gesture of kindness is what saw her through. And she says, I've been showered by it. And she actually goes to the trouble, which is a part of my point about understanding what ideas mean. You know, kindness is bandied about, another word thrown around all the time. But Suu Kyi defines it this way. Kindness is to respond with sensitivity and human warmth to the hopes and needs of others. Even the briefest touch of kindness can lighten a heavy heart. Kindness can change the lives of people. And the fact that she has initiated the release of political prisoners, the bringing of democracy, the openings, that we've established relations with the United States again, this woman has done all of that, insisting upon nonviolence. And she says, the biggest job I've got is to work on myself for the rest of my life. That's my biggest project, to be sure that I remain nonviolent in my thoughts. She said, you know, I've got a temper. I'll bang the piano keys every now and then.
She'd sit in the living room where she's under house arrest and take other frustration by pounding on the piano.
Right. Little Mozart knocked out.
Marietta McCarty, author, educator, consultant, and professional conversation instigator, is our guest. Her latest book is titled The Philosopher's Table. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've only got a couple minutes to take more calls, and we've got lines open. So if you want to talk to Marietta, please do get to the phone right now and dial in at 888-WMRA-TALK. What's your definition of kindness, Marietta?
I'll go with Suu Kyi, that it is a response. So it's active. It's not something that's latent, and you can be a kind person. But that kindness is an actual response with sensitivity and warmth to the hopes and needs of others. And I think what's important, Tom, is that it's not just the needs, but it's also the hopes of others, so that we can encourage people in their dreams and what they would like for the future and things that they think they might not be able to accomplish, and their wishes for their family, for their friends, that kindness is to encourage them in that way with sensitivity and with some warmth. There's nothing fake about it. It's active, and brings out the best in our own hearts. That's what I like about it, to respond that way.
Marietta McCarty, you've traveled to many parts of the world outside the United States.
Yes.
Do you find we in this country have any harder or easier time with some of the concepts that you talk about in your book, some of the ability to make connections with other human beings?
You know, as sometimes when I'm just coming back from another country, I might think that, Tom, but then upon reflection, I realized that people are pretty much the same. I think that what might happen in countries that are particularly addicted to, not just dependent on, but addicted to technology, that we've got an isolation going on in those countries, and that's not exclusively the United States, so that community and this coming together for dinner, which is why I so much want this to happen, this breaking bread over good conversation, that when people are sitting at the dinner table with the headphones on, as you and I are wearing right now, and you know, they're on family vacation but doing Facebook, that sort of thing that isolates us, I think, might be hurting us more than some other places, but there are plenty of other technologically dependent countries as well. I see that, you know, the Industrial Revolution, 19th century, brought about tremendous isolation and fragmentation, and I think we've got to be very careful with our use of technology right now.
Earlier in the hour, our caller, Lori, was talking about what, to me, she didn't put it this way, but reminded me of families around a Thanksgiving dinner where you've got an uncle or an aunt who's famous for loudly proclaiming their political views, and anybody who disagrees with them is an idiot. In essence, what Lori was saying, how do I deal with people who, when we're trying to discuss ideas, is so invested in theirs that they're committed to arguing with anybody who sees things differently? I'm curious if now you mentioned that one of the things that you've done in this book is 12 months of suggestions of getting people together over a dinner table with certain types of meals, certain types of ideas for discussion, that those ideas are supposed to be so gentle that they'll help prevent that kind of arguing. But for the people who know exactly what I'm talking about and have a next Thanksgiving or family holiday coming up, do you have a magic bullet for when Uncle Hank gets on his high horse and starts loudly proclaiming that his view is the right view and he won't listen to anybody else?
Sure. I would say to Uncle Hank, would he like any more potatoes? And then I would ask him questions. I would listen to what he had to say, and I wouldn't refute what he says. I would ask him questions. So when he proclaims something, and, you know, I'm not big on proclamations. I'm big on questions and genuine sort of this loving strife of back and forth, good, energetic conversations. Proclamations stop the conversation, but questions don't. So I think if I ask, you know, gosh, Uncle Hank, how long have you thought that? Where did you get that idea? I've never thought that. So I'm wondering if you can help me understand that. Then what I've done is I've given Uncle Hank his proclamation back. And he's going to have to do something with that. So I've encouraged students, and I've had, you know, students in such difficult situations over the course of my years of teaching who want to know how to handle this in a relationship or in the workplace or whatever. What do I do? And I almost always suggest ask questions. Don't go in there and confront it. You are confronting it. You're dealing with it. But ask questions. It gives the other person a voice. And it will make a conversation of it.
And hearing you say that, it reminds me that Lori's call came in just as you were starting to talk about the concept of grace. And I interrupted you to take the series of calls that were coming in then. And Lori said something about how much she liked what you had said already about the concept of grace. In about a minute or so we have left, you have more on that topic you'd like to offer?
Well, I think I'm remembering a child philosopher in Massachusetts, and I asked them what one idea, this group of sixth graders, what one idea, if you understood it better, would you like to know? And when I got to her, she said, I would like to understand grace.
And this was a little girl whose name was Grace.
That's right. But she had her name over her hand over her name tag, so I couldn't see it. And then when she unveiled it, I thought, and she said, the reason I would like to understand it is I think it would help me with everything, with sports, chores, friendships, and most especially my troubles, if I really understood grace. And she began to move her hand as if, you know, I could somehow glide and slide and give and take my way through difficulty if I had this quality of grace and if I could grow in it. So it's this fluid, light, engaged, yielding but not weak way of being in the world. And I think that's one thing I'm hoping for these dinners, Tom, is that a certain temperament and a certain tone develops at these dinner parties so that they are truly full of grace.
Our guest has been teacher, philosopher, education consultant, and author Marietta McCarty. Her newest book is titled The Philosopher's Table, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club, Monthly Conversation, Music, and Recipes. Marietta, so great to spend time with you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Virginia Insights executive producer is Matt Binga. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you get to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Ms. McCarty is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.